We're going to bring Senate Finance to order. Time is 1:38, and with us today, Senator Olson, Senator Dunleavy, Senator Bishop, and Vice Chair Faircliff. So we have a quorum to get started. I know Senator Kelly will be here shortly. He's in Hess helping make a quorum there. Before we broke for lunch, we were discussing House Bill 379, oil and gas property. Representative Nagyak was presenting. Senator Olson, I believe this is your bill as well, right?
That's correct, Mr. Chairman. If I can just make a few comments.
Yeah, please do. And Representative Nagyak, if you want to come back to the table too, please.
First of all, I just want to point out, Mr. Chairman, and thank you very much for hearing this bill on short notice. It's the number one priority of the North Slope Borough. We have spoken to industry, and they don't have a problem with it, as well as there's no loss of revenue to the state. And so with that, I'm glad for your consideration.
Okay, thank you. Person Nagyak?
For any questions you have on the bill, for one, we've been waiting a long time for this. And as the senator said, this has been one of the priorities of the borough for many years. And I think this was a workable solution to the problem we have. And we have Rob online from the North Slope Borough. If you have any questions,
okay, very good. I don't have the online sheets yet. Yeah, go ahead, Senator Olson.
Mr. Chairman, I have a question for the bill sponsor.
Your
okay, go ahead. Okay.
Okay, Senator Olson, go ahead.
It's more for a clarification. Representative Nagyak, as the former North Slope Borough Mayor, how have you seen the budget? How do you see this budget as if you were the mayor again? And how advantages do you see with this bill and how it affects the operating budget of the North Slope Borough?
Oh, it would be very helpful. I think, we've built the infrastructure in the North Slope since the borough was formed. And we've built all the schools and clinics and airports and everything else. But now we need to maintain all the infrastructure we built. And I think this will make it easier to plan for projects every year. And we can concentrate on looking at what's needed in the villages, because there's a lot of jobs. There's not very many jobs in the villages. I think this would boost the local economy, and we could fix a lot of the things that need fixing right now.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, thank you, Senator Olson. Representative Nagyak, I don't know if this is a fair question for you or there are some folks online. We have Bob Elkins and then also Matt Fonder. And the commissioner was here earlier. Oh, there she is. Okay. So my understanding here, this bill is just giving the North Slope Borough more flexibility on how to use the money for operating versus capital. And at what mill rate are you currently at? 18 or
18.5.
Okay.
Through the chair, I'm sorry, Mr. Chair. Yeah. We've always had 18.5 except for 1 year. I think we had a 19 mill rate, but that was for 1 year. But ever since the borough was created, we've always had 18.5.
Okay, very good. And you're not proposing to change that?
No.
Okay.
No, sir. That's why we're here, to be able to have some flexibility to do things, Mr. Chair, to be able to address some of the issues in terms of, things falling apart and all that. We can address those much quicker than, I think, through the bonding process.
Okay, and I will ask the commissioner as well. It's my understanding that there's no difference in the amount that the state receives from oil proceeds, nor is there any difference in the amount that the oil companies pay. Is that correct?
Yes, sir. I'm sorry.
Okay.
I thought you were addressing me.
No, I'll address the commissioners.
I've been preparing this for this hearing for a while, and now my brain's going haywire.
Yeah, you're doing great. Senator Dunleavy, did you have a question?
Sure. I think it may be best addressed to our DOR commissioner.
Okay. And Senator Hoffman, thank you for joining us. Okay. Yeah, I think we're good. Representative Nagyak.
Thank you.
Yeah. Yeah, Commissioner, if you would join us, please.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
For the record, Angela Rodell, Commissioner for the Department of Revenue. I'll just start with making a few comments, and then I'd be happy to answer questions that the committee has. This is a bill that we worked with to ensure that it was revenue neutral. We recognize that municipalities throughout the state that have oil and gas property may need flexibility to differentiate between their operating budgets and their debt service. And this was an opportunity to give those communities that have oil and gas property a chance to adjust that accordingly without affecting the state's financial picture at this time, nor increase taxes to the taxpayers within those communities. So we think that this is a neutral bill that gives the flexibility to the communities that need it. So with that, I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. I know Senator Dunleavy, but let me ask, does this impact the other cities like Valdez or Fairbanks?
Mr. Chairman, it affects any community that has oil and gas property in their jurisdiction. So yes, it does affect Valdez. It affects Fairbanks, North Star Borough, any of those communities.
Okay. Just for my own information, is the Kenai Sedona included?
I know I have Matt Fonder, my tax division director, online, and I'm drawing a blank right now as to whether or not Kenai actually has any oil and gas property. Matt may know for sure.
Okay. I think they do, but...
Mr. Chairman, on that point...
Go ahead, Senator Olson.
The communities, Commissioner Rodell, on that... You've named some communities that are within boroughs. What about those in the unorganized boroughs? Are they affected at all?
Through the chair, Senator Olson, I don't know the answer to that question, and I apologize for not knowing that. Again, I'm going to go to my lifeline, my tax division director, but I don't want to give you a wrong answer. So,
thank you, Matt, Mr. Chairman.
Sure. Great. Why don't we go to your lifeline first before we forget the questions, and then we'll go to Senator Dunleavy. Matt, are you online? Matt Fonder?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I'm here. Can you hear me okay?
Yep, we sure can. Did you hear the questions that we had?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I did.
Okay.
For the record, my name is Matt Fonder, and I'm the director of the tax division, and I think that I can answer both your question, Mr. Chairman, and Senator Olson's question by referring everyone to page 48 of our revenue sources book. If you don't have it in front of you right now, we do have a table in there which indicates the breakout of property taxes and how they're shared, but that chart does indicate that Kenai does have oil and gas property. The tax was $19.8 million last year. The local share was $9.7 million, so the state received $10.1 million in property taxes on the oil and gas property in Kenai last year. Now, in regards to the unorganized boroughs, I don't believe assess any property taxes, so the local share on the unorganized line on that chart is zero. So the tax on oil and gas property in unorganized boroughs was $58.9 million, and that all went to the state.
Okay, very good. Senator Dunleavy.
Thank you, through the chair. This could be directed to the commissioner or her help. I just want to make sure. So, it's the state will take no hit on this, correct?
Through the chair, Senator Dunleavy, that is correct, assuming all the locals keep their property taxes as they currently are in place and don't make changes at the local level, which they're entitled to do both under current statute and under this bill.
So if they make changes to their local tax setup, it could impact the state?
Through the chair, Senator Dunleavy, yes. But that's also true of the current statute,
right.
Just to be clear.
I was just going to say, so it doesn't matter if this bill is adopted or not. If they change their tax structure, it can impact the state.
Correct.
Does this bill change, again, any of the other boroughs that has this type of property in there for taxing purposes? Does this particular bill change their status if they don't change their taxes, they don't do anything, but the bill in and of itself, will it change their status in any way, negatively or positively?
Through the chair, Senator Dunleavy, it's possible that it might positively impact certain communities that have very low tax rates right now. For any municipality that is at the 20 mil rate that the state level has, that's fully deductible, they will not see any change. So really, it's the positive impact to the communities that have lower tax rates.
Just to follow up from the chair. So Valdez, for instance, will not be harmed by this bill?
Through the chair, Senator Dunleavy, that's my understanding, correct.
Fairbanks, North Star Borough?
They should not be harmed by this bill.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Can you explain why the law was put into place in the first place for 9.808 mils for operating and the difference for capital?
Through the chair, Senator Hoffman, I'm not sure who's the 9.8 mils.
Yeah, the current statute. Why was there those requirements?
Section 9.08 mil.
9.08, yeah.
Through the chair, Senator Hoffman, my understanding is that the 9 mils is the rate set by the local community, not set by the state of Alaska. So the state of Alaska has in place a statute that directs all localities, whether or not you have oil and gas property tax, at a mil rate of 30 mils. That gets adjusted through this multiplier factor into a corresponding mill rate, and for the North Slope Borough, I believe it's in that 9 mill rate for the operating budget. And I'm doing this off of memory, and I know I have the North Slope Borough online, and they can probably speak to it better. But for all communities in the state of Alaska without regard to oil and property tax, we have a limit of 30 mils, and the communities are allowed to determine within that 30 mil rate what they want their millage rates to be for operating budget purposes on property tax.
Go ahead, Senator Hoffman.
Mr. Chairman, the third paragraph that was provided to us by the sponsor states that the restriction applies to the 18.5, and that's why they're coming before the legislature to ask for flexibility. So the current law, Alaska statutes 29.45, require them to spend 9.08 on operating and 9.45 on capital. That's why we have the bill. They want that removed. So I'm wondering why that was put into place in the first, back when this was set up.
Through the chair, Senator Hoffman, the reason for the multiplier, the cap on oil and gas property to begin with, when we do the conversion, was that when I look back, and this hasn't been adjusted for my understanding is in 40 years this law has been in place, so I'm going by what our records are showing, but my understanding is that there was a issue of fairness or equity. So in other words, communities that didn't have the benefit of oil and gas property the state had a desire to transfer some of that wealth and use some of that wealth to help those communities that didn't have it. And so what they did is they created this multiplier to limit how much tax could be calculated by the local governments on their oil and gas property so as to ensure that there would be some revenue that would flow to the state that could then be used for communities that don't have the benefit of oil and gas property. That's what I've been told is why the multiplier was put in place to begin with.
Follow up, Senator Hoffman?
No follow up.
Okay. Additional questions? We could ask Mr. Elkins, North Slope Borough, Senator Hoffman, if you want some history.
Actually, I would, Mr. Chairman, okay. Just so we all clear it up here, because the sponsor statement clearly says that it's in statute that 9.08 mills has to be used for the operating budget, and the remaining can be used for debt service. 9.42 can be used for the debt service on the bonds that, for the capital project. So if Mr. Elkins would at least give his understanding of what is there.
Okay. Mr. Elkins, you online, sir?
Yes, sir.
Okay. Did you hear Senator Olson and Senator Hoffman's question?
Yes, sir. It's a little confusing. What the committee has in front of them now is the mill rate that was set for the current operating year. And that mill rate is actually arrived at through the calculation. It's a per capita value, statewide per capita value, multiplied by that 225% that's currently in statute. And then that is multiplied by your total number of residents to arrive at a equivalent tax base. And then that equivalent tax base is multiplied by that 30 mil cap that the commissioner spoke to. And what that does is that gives you a maximum dollar amount that you can spend on operations. So it actually limits the tax revenue that you can spend on operations. That amount is then converted into a mill rate based on your total assessed value. And then within the North Slope Borough, we squeeze our operational budget into that amount, and then we have always limited ourselves to that 18.5 mil. So that tells us how much we have available for debt service for school construction, school repair, the repair improvement, major repairs or improvement of our assets, so that. That mill rate, that 9.08, it's not that same amount every year. It can be, I've seen it as high as 10 and as low as in the 8s.
Go ahead, Senator Olson.
Mr. Elkins, the original question, though, by Senator Hoffman is why was this formula put in place and using so much money to be used for debt service when you could take some of that money for the plan now is take the money that's used for debt service and use for your operating budget. That's the original question. Why was it put in this formula to essentially bind your hands so that you have so much money that's dedicated to debt service?
Senator Olson, I mean, I wasn't here when the bill was originally passed, but my understanding is, and what I've been told from folks that have been around that long, is that there was this equity argument, and the original logic that was spoken to was that it would be very difficult for boroughs to gain approval to sell debt. And so the original thought behind this with the operating tax cap is that even though there's that maximum of 20 mils, that this would keep the local governments somewhere below that 10 mils, so it would provide an additional 10 mils that would go to the state. And it what I've been told is, again, it was often an equity argument that underdeveloped areas would then share in some of the property tax revenue of oil and gas assets.
Thank
Go
you,
ahead.
Chairman.
Okay. All right. If there's no other questions for Mr. Elkins or Ms. Bonder, Commissioner, I wanted to ask you on your fiscal note, you made it indeterminate?
Mr. Chairman, I apologize. Yes, it is indeterminate because if we assume all of the communities continue to operate as they have, it would have zero impact. If the communities adjust their mill rate because of this bill, there could be both positive adjustments to the state with additional revenue. For example, if they lower their mill rate to take advantage of the greater operating flexibility, that would have a positive advantage to the state. If they raise their mill rate, it will reduce revenue to the state. So that's why we have an indeterminate fiscal note.
Okay, very good. All right, thank you, Commissioner. Was there anyone here in Juneau who wanted to testify on this bill? I don't have anyone signed up either here in Juneau or in online. Is that correct? Okay. Senator Fairclough, I don't know if, did you have any questions on this bill before we take action?
Nope.
Okay. Let's do a brief at ease. Okay, we're back. I don't believe there was any more questions. We closed public testimony on the bill. We're going to hold this for another day, Representative Nagyak. I think the committee is very much supportive, but we'd like to sleep on it yet. Okay. Thank you for joining us today, and thank you, committee members. I think we're going to do a PERS presentation, Senator Fairclough.
Mr. Chairman, did we hear from the assessors, the state assessor's office? Because if you did it while I was, I apologize, I had two bills up over in House Finance that
Department of Revenue Tax. I don't have the...
If you're going to hold it overnight, I'll talk with them offline.
Yeah,
thank you.
That'd be good. Okay, with that, I think we're going to switch gears here for a little bit and have a couple slides on the PERS. If the chairman's not ready for that, we'll pick up the next bill, which is House Bill 308. So with that, we're going to take a brief at ease.
Council from Senate Finance. The continuing saga. We have David Teal to talk us through some PERS issues today. We don't have a bill yet from House, in the House, so we'll go through this presentation, get a little better idea regarding PERS, and get the committee up to speed, and then we can pull out and go back to just bills. Okay. So, David, if you would walk us through your spreadsheets and graphs on PERS.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
David, for the record, at the table are Senator Faircloth, Senator Bishop, Senator Dunleavy, Senator Hoffman, Senator Meyer, myself, Senator Kelly. Go ahead.
Okay. And I'm David Teal, Director of Legislative Finance Division. Yesterday, we went through TERS, but didn't have the information. I just received it about 10 minutes before the meeting began, and so was able to graph some of the information from the actuaries. So the chart that you're looking at now is very similar to the ones you saw yesterday. As I said, PERS is going to be nearly indistinguishable from the TERS graphs. This is combined PERS and TERS. You can see the base case, lowest cost in the early years, highest total cost. The governor's dark blue line puts in $3 billion total cash infusion and ends up costing less in the long run. All I put on this graph were two scenarios for PERS. The graph would just get covered if I started doing level dollar and level percent for each of the half dozen options. So this is just a sample of what can happen. A $4 billion cash infusion obviously costs more in the early years, but it becomes your cheapest in the long run. If you went with a $3 billion cash infusion, like the governor suggested, but go to level percent of pay amortization, it is cheaper than the base case by about $500 million per year, and that ends in this middle period, ends up being a couple billion dollars cheaper. But then, of course, it does pass the level dollar and ends up being a bit more expensive. But as you know, any time in the future, you can increase the cash infusion or make other changes to the system, including your amortization methods, and change the slope of this line. So, as I said yesterday, the lines out in the far future get further and further away from a reliable prediction or projection. And for those of you that like to see it in numbers instead of graphs, here we have the base scenario going up to over $1 billion before it tapers off. The governor with his $3 billion cash infusion, $500 per year, and note where they stop, because that may be another important consideration for you. The 25-year amortization, level dollar and level percent, both extend slightly, another 3 years. If you look just at PERS, which is something that you didn't see yesterday, it's some interesting changes from TERS, caused by the differential between the rate that we're being charged, that we charge to employers, the rate cap, if you want to think of it that way, which is 12.56% in TERS, and the normal cost is 12. So there's very little difference between the full employer rate and the normal cost of the program. In TERS, that rate cap is 22%, and the normal cost is about 10. So there's 12 points difference, and that means that there's a lot more money coming in from employers as we replace defined benefits employees with defined contribution employees. The cash flow is maintained. So you can see that a $3 billion cash infusion into PERS means you now paid it off in about 5 years. I'm not sure you'd want to do that, because then the rates go to zero. And if the rates go to zero, then all employers benefit equally, which means that a lot of this cash infusion benefits non-state employers. The same is true of a $2 billion cash infusion, where you're looking at level dollar being fairly high cost, and bringing it up here, so the costs tend to be higher through the thing all the way out until the end. A $1 billion cash infusion into PERS does get you to the 70% funding ratio that we were concerned about yesterday. And if you went with the level percent, it is significantly cheaper than either the base or the governor. Roughly parallels the governor's plan until the very end, where the cost is about the same. And again, anytime the legislature chooses to, out in 2028 or 38, that amortization method can be changed, or the amount of cash in the system can be changed. That's really the end of it, unless you want to look at the numbers, and the numbers simply show the same thing the graph showed. And I prefer the graphs in something like this, because the numbers lend a degree of accuracy that probably isn't really there. You're better off just looking at the graphs and saying it's this far apart, rather than trying to say it's $512 million.
Thanks, David. Questions from the committee? Thanks, David. We talked this out pretty well yesterday. Senator Fairclough, did you have any comments? And Senator Meyer, you need to get back to moving bills, so let's not take any more time with formalities. I'm going to have it at ease.
Okay, we're back. Senate Finance, we're left off on House Bill 308, which is Representative Lindsey Holmes. Representative Holmes, please join us. Welcome to Senate Finance. Your bill is Alaska Securities Act exemptions. So if you could introduce the bill to us and tell us what it does and why we should support it.
Absolutely.
The floor is yours. Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. It is a pleasure to be here this afternoon. Thank you for hearing my bill in the final week of session. House Bill 308 is the Alaska Securities Act. Don't let the title scare you. What it does is it's an attempt to help small Alaska businesses that mostly are, that are starting up raise capital. Right now, if you have an Alaska business and you're trying to raise money, generally they call it the sort of the friends and family. It's you're trying to get a business off the ground and people say, okay, I want to kick in some money on this. You're not required to do an official registration with the state. You're required to give your investors information about the company and comply with a bunch of other requirements. You also have to file a form with the state of Alaska with the banking and securities and pay a $50 fee, which is $125 if you want to expedite their review. It's not that complicated a form, but it tends to make people nervous. They're filing it with the state. They tend to go out and hire a lawyer. They tend to spend a lot of time, and if you have time, Kevin Anselm, who's the director of banking and securities, is on the line, has told me it actually takes quite a bit of staff time because people get nervous about it, and they call the division a lot to make sure they're getting it right. The division doesn't actually do anything with this form. And so the division itself actually approached me about eliminating this requirement. It would be for Alaska businesses who are raising money from other Alaskans. It has to be 25 or fewer Alaskans. So these are not huge securities. There's a requirement that you can't go out and market it. It's not people who are going out and soliciting. This is sort of the people who you know. And it would simply eliminate that filing requirement with the state. All of the state's consumer protection laws would stay in effect. If an individual investor is somehow defrauded, they have all of the protections. The Division of Banking and Securities retains all of the rights to go after people, as do the individual investors. None of that is affected by this bill. That is the main thrust of the bill. There are two other small provisions. One just simply gives the division a few additional days on certain filings. These are filings when companies come in and say, we want to rescind some stock, we made a mistake, or there's a problem. Right now, the division only has 2 days to review those. They're asking for 10 days, a little bit more time to file. And the final thing that it does is a cleanup relating to ANCs and native corporations. The Federal General Accountability Office pointed out we have an ambiguity in our statutes right now. For original native corporation stocks that were issued, they're filed under federal law generally, and so they're not required under Alaska statute to file with the state of Alaska. But we forgot to mention at the time anything about reissuance or transfers. And now we're in the issue of the afterborns, people who were born after 1972, or the transfers. And the General Accountability Office pointed out there's an ambiguity in our statute. It's not clear whether those are required to be filed with the state. This clarifies that so long as they are in compliance with federal law, we treat those the same way that we treated original issuances of native corporation stock. Mr. Chairman, that's the bill. I would appreciate your support.
Great, thank you.
Oh, and I should note very quickly, there is a fiscal note. That's why we're here. There's no actual fiscal cost to the state, but because we are eliminating the filing, the department has anticipated there will be about $6,800, I believe, in lost revenues simply due to the reduction in those filing fees.
Okay. Questions from the committee? We do have a couple people online to testify. Maybe we can take testimony and then come back to any questions. Did you have something, Senator? Okay. All right. Let's go to Alan Johnson. Or Johnston, excuse me.
My name is Alan Johnston. I'm calling from Anchorage. I used to be in the investment business. I was a regional manager for a New York Stock Exchange firm for 36 years here in Anchorage and Fairbanks. And I've been assisting a volunteer for the past year, working with the municipality, was involved in getting $13 million of federal funds to create angel funds in Alaska, which has to be matched one-to-one private sector, so it'll be $26 million here. And Banking Securities has done a phenomenal job in helping out with the education, because a lot of people aren't familiar with working with securities laws in any state. Alaska's 50th in the United States for risk capital, with third in median family income. And what we're trying to do is close that gap, is getting people to invest locally and create local businesses. And Banking Securities has done a phenomenal job. We've realized, as some of these funds are starting, that they're finding a lot of additional costs and friction that doesn't need to be there on the state side or on the investors' side. And these technical corrections will simplify things considerably, so things can be a lot smoother in creating new funds and people raising money to make these businesses happen. And I highly support this technical correction, and I really appreciate what Banking Securities has been doing for the past year to accommodate and assist in making this happen.
Okay. Questions for Mr. Johnston? Seeing none, thank you for your testimony today. Let's go.
Thank you.
Yep. Let's go on now to, is it Anselm? Kevin?
Yes. Okay. Good afternoon. This is Kevin Anselm. I'm the director of the Division of Banking and Securities with the Department of Commerce, Community, and Economic Development. I can go through the bill if you would like. Actually, Representative Holmes summarized everything very well, and I know that you are pressed on time, but I'm happy to do that or happy to answer any questions that anyone might have relating to the bill.
No, I think we're pretty good on the bill. Did you have any comments that you wanted to make on it?
Nothing specifically. There is a PowerPoint in your materials that may be helpful. And just a little bit of an overview that generally most securities must be either registered or exempt from registration. And this bill doesn't really change that requirement. It eliminates the paperwork and the filing fees with the division for the small offerings, 10 or fewer or 25 or fewer investors, depending on the situation, and for offerings to existing securities holders. And then the other two cleanup items relating to rescission offers, allowing the division a little more time so that we can be sure that we meet our consumer protection requirements so that if a company is rescinding an offer or a sale of stock, that we have an opportunity to look over that before the transaction happens. And then lastly, to clarify the issues with the ANCSA corporation after-issued stock. And that is lined out more on the last page of that PowerPoint, if that is of interest. It really includes after-issued securities to Alaska Natives born after December 18, 1971, descendants of Alaska Natives, eligible Alaska Natives who maybe have missed enrollment, and Alaska Native shareholders who are 65 years or older. And there are a few others, too, but those are the primary ones.
Okay. Thank you for that explanation. Questions? Seeing none, thank you very much for joining us this afternoon. Okay, was there anyone else who wanted to testify? Here in Juneau, perhaps? Okay. Seeing none, then we'll go ahead and close public testimony. Okay, you went over the fiscal note. Is there any questions from the committee members? Okay. Looks like good bill, Representative Holmes.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
But we tend to like to sleep on it, so we'll revisit this tomorrow.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Holmes.
Thank you to the committee.
Thank you for being with us.
Appreciate it.
Okay, let's go on to House Bill 361, licensing of behavior analysts. Representative Sadler's bill. Representative Sadler, welcome to Senate Finance.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. It's a pleasure to be back in this room. For the record, this is Representative Dan Sadler, House District 12, Eagle River, Birchwood, North Jay Bear. Appreciate the members of the committee hearing House Bill 361 at this late date, but autism, sir, is a significant and growing problem in our state. Applying the national rates of incidence to the 2010 Alaska Census, we see about 2% roughly of Alaska children are born with this developmental disability, which is distinguished by diminished ability to communicate, by social isolation, and other symptoms. While it's not curable, autism is treatable. Scientific studies have shown that early intensive treatment, guided by the principles of applied behavior analysis, or ABA, offers the best opportunity for people with autism to learn how to function productively in society. ABA is recognized as the basis for the most effective form of autism treatment by the U.S. Surgeon General, the National Institutes of Child Health, and the American Academy of Pediatrics. ABA is best understood as behavior modification. It assesses the relationship between the environment of a person and their behavior, and then sculpts and arranges that environment and the interactions between the person and that environment to achieve the desired behavior. 4 years of research, Mr. Chairman, have shown that nearly half the people with autism who receive intensive early treatment do not require lifelong services and support. About another quarter can achieve normal functioning after about 2 or 3 years, and sadly to say about a quarter do not benefit. I will say for the record, my son has benefited immensely from early intensive ABA therapy. This benefit can mean savings of between $200,000 and $1.1 million over the life of an individual in money not spent on institutional care and incarceration, on emergency intervention, and lost productivity. Now, an essential element in successful autism treatment is a well-trained behavioral analyst, therapist that is, and the gold standard for this is the nationally recognized credential of the Board Certified Behavior Analyst, or BCBA. Now, to receive the BCBA certification, applicants will need a minimum of a master's degree, plus extensive training and passage of the challenging BCBA examination. So the state already supports the training and certification of BCBAs through a grant to the Center for Human Development at the University of Alaska Anchorage. There is about 25-26 BCBAs and assistant BCBAs in Alaska today, and another 7 or 8 are in the pipeline getting their required experience and training before they can pass that national certification test. However, because they are not formally licensed, Alaskans with BCBAs cannot bill health insurance for their services at a rate that reflects their high degree of training and professional skill. This bill, HB 361, addresses this situation by providing that those holding the BCBA or the BCABA credential in Alaska be licensed not by a professional board, but by the Division of Professional Licensing and the State Department of Commerce, Community, and Economic Development. I would note, sir, that this is one of the what we call the low-hanging fruit from the ongoing work of the Autism Task Force, which was, wow. I hear the airplane taking off.
Hold off just a second.
Thank you very much. That's the Autism Task Force was created by legislation following the insurance mandate, and we felt that this was one thing that could be done this session, we hope, that would provide immense benefit at a short time frame and low cost for the people of the state. In summation, sir, by ensuring licensure and higher standards of practice for BCBAs and BCABAs in Alaska, House Bill 361 will encourage more people to provide autism services in Alaska, offer higher reimbursement rates for professional providers, protect the public by establishing high levels of professional practice, provide better outcomes for many Alaska children with autism, save the state money by avoiding the cost for institutional care, and improve the quality of life for hundreds of Alaskans and their families. I appreciate your time and attention. Be glad to answer what questions I have. We have just a few people available to testify online, and I believe the department's professional licensing director is in the audience for questions on licensing. Thank you for your time, sir.
Okay. Very good. Representative Sadler, is there any questions? Okay, seeing none at this time, we'll go right to the public testimony. Lori Nunn?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Lori Unum, and I am a lawyer and a mother of a child with autism. I'm pleased to testify today in strong support of HB 361. I come in various capacities. I'm Vice President of State Government Affairs for Autism Speaks, which is the world's leading autism research and advocacy nonprofit organization. And in that capacity, I had the pleasure of working on the Autism Insurance Bill, SB 74, a few years ago, and got to meet a few of you at that time. So it's a pleasure to be back before this committee. And I'm also a founder of a Center for ABA, Applied Behavior Analysis Therapy, in South Carolina, where my child gets treatment. I also am a law professor at George Washington University Law School. I teach a course called Autism and the Law. And then, as I mentioned, I'm also the mother of a 13-year-old son with autism. So I approach this issue from various capacities, both personal and professional. And I think this is an excellent bill It is well structured. It takes into account a number of considerations, including people who are moving from other states to practice behavior analysis. It does have some exemptions written into it for people who need not have license, such as a family member of a person with autism. It does rely on the existing national board certification, which Representative Sadler mentioned, which I think is the right structure for a licensing bill. I've had the opportunity to work on various state legislation that has created licensure for behavior analysts. And when I testified on this bill on the House side, there were 13 states that license behavior analysts currently, and as of today, there are 15 states. And in fact, since you met this morning, the Tennessee legislature passed a behavior analyst licensure bill today. So there are about to be 16 and perhaps hopefully 17 with your bill. So I do think this bill, it contains disciplinary mechanism to ensure adequate consumer protection, as Representative Sadler mentioned. It creates a temporary license for those who have been practicing in the state. So both from the mom perspective, looking at consumer protection, as well as from the legal perspective, I think it's an excellent bill, and I highly recommend passage. And I'd be happy to entertain questions.
Okay. Thank you for the testimony. Questions, committee members? Seeing none, thank you very much for your testimony today.
Thank you.
Yep. And let's go now to Rebecca Edge.
Hi, I'm Rebecca Edge, and I'm the owner of Behavior Matters. We're a behavior analytic clinic in Eagle River, and I'm also the parent of two children with autism. I currently have a staff of 24 that are serving clients in the greater Anchorage area, Matsu Valley, Talkeetna, Kenai, and Juneau. We provide services to our clients in the home, school, community, and our clinic. On staff right now, we have one doctorate level BCBA, five master's level BCBAs, and two bachelor's level assistant board certified behavior analysts. And we also have four employees that have completed the requirements to become certified. We are in favor of a licensure for certified behavior analysts. It will allow us to continue to work with our current families while providing a professional rate that we feel are consistent with our training and expertise. We attempt to bill multiple insurance companies, TRICARE, Blue Cross Blue Shield, Premera, ODS, Aetna, United Healthcare, Cigna, and Assurance. But the only reliable payer currently is TRICARE. Even with the most recent insurance mandate, some of the insurance companies have refused to pay for or authorize services, while other insurance companies will pay for services, but usually after several remits and multiple phone calls, and at times have even called for a refund. So with the licensure of behavior analysts, it will hopefully open up the door so that we can serve more of the Alaskan children and build a stronger network of behavior analysts within our state. Thank you. Do you have any questions?
Questions? Seeing none. Thank you for your testimony.
Thank you very much.
So was there anyone else online? Anyone else here in Juneau? Okay. Seeing none. I believe I'll have a question for Ms. Chambers, but I think I'm good with Ms. Representative Sadler, you're welcome to stay there as well. Actually, I do have a question for you. This pertains to other things than just autism. Is that correct?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, that's correct. If members are familiar with the Complex Behavioral Collaborative, which is another program that the state funds, the principles of applied behavior analysis have applicability to dealing with an awful lot of developmental disabilities with special needs children, with FAS, FAE people. So the principles, basically the principles of good education and ABA will have application beyond just autism.
Okay. Do you have any idea how many people would want the behavioral license?
Mr. Chairman, currently, as I say, there's about 25 people. I couldn't give you a direct number. Perhaps Rebecca Edge, as a clinic owner, might be able to give a better perspective on that. I do know that if licensures, I met several times with the interim with BCBAs, And the concern is that if they cannot get licensure, they cannot get reimbursed a higher rate, and they may devolve to other less remunerative professions, might leave the state to get better income elsewhere. Having the state encourage people by paying their way to get BCBAs and having licensure to make it more profitable to do so is going to encourage more people. I can't say how many, though. There is certainly a need for autism therapists and BCBAs in Alaska.
Okay, great. Do other states have this?
Yes, sir. As Lori Unum just said, I think we've just seen, the 17 states. It is a trend across the state, yes, across the nation.
Okay, great. Thank you, Representative Sadler. Ms. Chambers, we're seeing a lot of you these days. Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Sarah Chambers. I'm the Director of the Division of Corporations, Business, and Professional Licensing.
Okay, great. Did you do the fiscal note that's attached?
I have inherited the fiscal note that's attached, Mr. Chairman, and I am familiar with it.
Yeah, I'm sorry?
I am familiar with the fiscal
note. Oh, you're familiar with it. Okay. It's indeterminate, and I was just reading the back page here, the third paragraph. What caught my attention was the last sentence where it says the financial impact of health care Medicaid services could be significant. Can you explain that, or is that a better question for Terry? Terry's online too, by the way.
Mr. Chairman, that would be Health and Social Services fiscal note. Commerce did also supply a fiscal note for 46.6.
Yes, you did. Okay. Yeah, yours is a little easier to understand. Okay. I will ask Health and Human Services about theirs, but Senator Fairclough, go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, I was with Ms. Chambers at the table. I'm hesitant to even bring it up, but we've said it before, we have an issue with licensure in the state of Alaska and being able to recover the fees, and this fiscal note is very low from the department, $4,000. I think we have on one of the fiscal notes, it's under 100, I believe, that I can't recall where it was at, but 80 something that on one of the fiscal notes of who would be licensed, and I'm concerned about what the fee the department is going to come up with to try to.
Thank you, Senator Fairclough. Through the chair, our fiscal note of $46,600 reflects the additional appropriation that is needed in order to implement the program. It is not the total cost of the program. We have been working with the sponsor to help provide additional information that would be an estimate of what additional costs could be anticipated based on similarly situated programs, and we have determined that the additional cost plus the fiscal note, looking at a licensure number of anywhere from 25 to 50 people, could result in a license from anywhere from $500 to $1,200 per license.
Mr. Chairman, my only concern there is that we have the issues of investigation that we've been having trouble with as far as the department being able to, the boards to be able to use the information that the department is providing them to manage the funds that they pay. I just here we go again, setting up another group of people that will require monitoring, and we have a huge issue with that right now, not necessarily the monitoring nor the boards that are supporting them, but just getting the money to work out. And that's not a reflection of Ms. Chambers at all.
No, Ms. Chambers inherited that. Representative Sandler, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Through the Chair, Senator Fairclough, I would note that the Ms. Chambers has said it would be about $1,300 per person in the first couple of years, the first biennial term, that would drop significantly thereafter to about $450 to $500 per licensee. And I would observe that with the between 25 and 50, that's a fairly small universe of licensees. So if you figure even 1%, 2% of bad actors, the likelihood of somebody in that small cohort of 25 to 50 being a bad actor requiring investigation is about as low as we can get it, just numerically.
Does that make you feel any better?
Mr. Chairman, I invite Representative Sadler to sit down at one of our meetings and see how the department spreads cost over licenses, and it's a flat rate. So it doesn't matter whether your particular licensing structure has investigations. You get the spread from everyone.
Through the chair, I should not argue statistics with a member of the Finance Committee.
There you go. Okay. If there's no other questions, then I'm going to ask a question of the Department of Health and Social Services. I believe that's Terry Keklak. Keklak. Terry, are you online?
Yes, good afternoon. This is Terry Keklak, and I'm with the Division of Behavioral Health in the Department of Health and Social Services. And I believe that there might be some others from the Division of Healthcare Services online also.
Ted
Etheridge, are you on?
I think you're it.
The Division of Healthcare Services actually developed a fiscal note that I could attempt to address questions if they're not available.
Okay, why don't you go ahead? You're the only one that had the nerve to call in today, so go ahead and, yep, you're brave enough to show up, so we're going to let you explain the fiscal note.
Okay, the fiscal note that's attached at this time is indeterminate, and that is primarily because until licensure takes place and other events occur, it is really difficult for the department to estimate the utilization that might occur as a result of this. Primarily, before it happens, we have to get approvals through CMS that the coverage would be paid to these independent practitioners under the EPSDT benefit, as currently they are not listed in the Medicaid statute as independent practitioners. So that would have to occur. Then we'd have to do some analysis of the need, a determination of medical necessity, utilization, determined services, and rates. And at that time, a better estimate could be done.
Okay. Senator Faircloth.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Terry, on the fiscal note, page number 2, it is indicating about 1,838 persons under the age of 21 with a diagnosis of autism. Understanding that 100% of families may not seek services, can you give us an example of what one person receiving those services might cost?
At this time, we're not really able to estimate that.
Recording started.
Until the other decisions are made in terms of what are the services that will be covered, what are the rates, and what are the medical necessity criteria, and a total benefit package that would be paid for a particular child, we can't do that estimate yet.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, Terry, I understand that that there's a wide range, but this is the Finance Committee, and you're the health in the health, and we have a fiscal note in front of us. Can you give us a range? Zero to 1,000, zero to 5,000 per individual?
Senator Faircloth, through the chair, I'm really not able to address any range at this time.
Mr. Chairman. Very good. Thank you, Terry. Okay. Any other questions, comments? Why don't we try to hone in on that dollar amount a little bit? So we're going to hold this one over as well. Thank you, Representative Sadler. Did I close public testimony?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Appreciate it. Glad to answer your questions on the
okay.
I'm out. Off time.
Thank you, Representative Sadler. We do have somebody else who does want to talk on the fiscal note, so let's go ahead and, is it Deborah Etheridge?
Hello, Mr. Chair. I am Deb Etheridge, and I work for Healthcare Services.
Okay. Did you hear some of Senator Faircloth's questions?
Yes, I have.
Okay.
I did hear some of the questions, and I want to make myself available to answer. Chair, through the chair, Alaska For the persons who are diagnosed with autism, we have to assume that there would be an initial assessment of children with autism who would be eligible for and need service. And in looking at other states, we compare the assessment costs is just for the assessment for the service is around $175 per assessment. If we estimate that 100% of persons under the age of 21 with a diagnosis of autism would receive a help assessment to determine their level of need, we could potentially estimate that the cost of the initial assessment in the first year would be around $321,000. And that's for the assessment. And then for the service, I think Terry Keklak testified correctly in that we'd have to make some determinations as to who would be eligible for that and what the rules or boundaries are about what service is provided and the amount of service that's provided. But it could be covered at a rate of up to $25 an hour, perhaps.
That gives us something, yeah. Okay, thank you for that.
You're very welcome.
Okay, well, we're still going to hold this over. And Representative Sanders, thank you very much.
Thank you, sir.
Yeah. No, not Pepper. All right, we're back. Senate Finance is back in order, and we're ready now for House Bill 160, licensing of athletic trainers. And we do have the sponsor here, Representative Thompson, and his trusty staff, Brody Anderson. If you guys would join us at the table, please. Welcome to Senate Finance. I'm glad to see someone else is trying to get licensing of athletic trainers. That was a bill I tried several years ago, so hopefully you'll have better luck than I. Anyway, Representative Thompson, if you could please introduce yourself, introduce the bill, and tell us why we should support it. The floor is yours.
I'm Steve Thompson, representative from Fairbanks, House District Number 3. I'd like to thank you, Mr. Chairman and Senators, for hearing this bill today. House Bill 160 would amend current statutes to establish licensing and regulations of athletic trainers in the state of Alaska. When we're talking about athletic trainers, we're talking about multi-skilled, mid-level medical care providers that provide unique combination of injury and illness treatment, rehabilitation, and injury prevention. They are similar to nurse practitioners, midwives, physician assistants, neuropathic physicians, and physical therapists, all of which are licensed in Alaska in order to provide immunity for healthcare providers. Certification is provided through the national organization, National Athletic Trainers Association. There are specific requirements before being issued a certification. First, there's mandatory post-secondary degree. Second, there's a formal instructions in extensive basic and applied sciences. Third is specific professional content. And fourth is comprehensive national examination through the Board of Certification, INC. House Bill 160 will require people using the title athletic trainer and working cooperatively under the supervision of a doctor to be licensed. Alaska is one of the final two states that doesn't currently license athletic trainers. Athletic trainers in Alaska asked for this bill to be introduced because they saw the need for being licensed in order to be recognized as healthcare providers. So I ask that you join me in supporting athletic trainers in our state.
Great. Thank you, Representative Thompson. Questions? Senator Fairclough?
Mr. Chairman, I believe my staff has met with the representative staff on an email that my office received on a concern that the current language as it's written would mean huge ramifications for people in school districts or others, that it actually would cover all athletic and exercise programs and activities for children and adults throughout the state. And if that's not the intent, that we needed to work on the language a bit. I don't know if you'd like to comment on that. I believe we provided you the email that our office received.
I'd like to have my staff, Brody Anderson, answer that, please.
All right, Brody, go ahead.
For the record, my name is Brody Anderson, staff to Representative Steve Thompson. Thank you, Chairman, and through the chair, Senator Fairclough. We are working directly with the co-chair's staff currently to have a CS that directly will address the concerns of fitness trainers and coaches and that relationship in an exemption of some sort. So we are working currently.
Okay, go ahead, Senator Fairclough.
Mr. Chairman, I'm not going to say the person who sent the email, but I just wanted to say thank you because these are the types of emails that are very responsive. This particular person actually offered a solution also, which was very helpful for us to work with your office. So I thank you for that consideration in advancing a change that would define more strictly what we're trying to get to here. Thank you.
Okay, great. Anything else? Any other questions? Okay, seeing none, we do have some folks that want to testify, and Brody, I do appreciate your working with Christine on a CS. Is that correct?
Thank you.
Just say yes.
Sorry.
You're working with my staff on the CS?
Senator, yes, we are correct.
Okay,
yes.
That's all I needed. Yes, works good. Okay, great. Let's go now to the public testimony. Let's see, we have, looks like, Lynn Young, and then Dr. Carruthers, who I introduced today. Yeah, good. I'm sorry? Eagle River, yes. Okay, Lynn, if you could introduce yourself and your affiliation, please. Go ahead.
Yes, sir. For the record, my name is Lynn Young. I'm a certified athletic trainer. I live in Eagle River, as Senator Fairclough just mentioned, and I do work in Anchorage. I'm also the secretary treasurer for the Alaska Athletic Trainers Association and the chair of the Governmental Affairs Committee.
Okay, great.
So, thank you.
Go ahead with your testimony, yes.
And I'd like to start by saying thank you for your support when we went around the first go around and we're back again. So hopefully I have a little bit more information to help this process. Athletic trainers are highly qualified, educated, and multi-skilled health professionals who collaborate with and work under the supervision of physicians. The services provided by athletic trainers consist of prevention, emergency care, clinical assessment, therapeutic intervention, and rehabilitation of injuries and medical conditions. Individuals who want to become athletic trainers must go through at a minimum a bachelor's degree at an accredited athletic training university. Once they suffice those requirements, then they're eligible to sit for the Board of Certification exam. This Board of Certification is quite rigorous, and upon completion of that, they are allowed to call themselves a certified athletic trainer. Once they are certified, they must maintain their credentials by taking 50 CEUs every 2 years, in addition to maintaining an emergency cardiac care course at the professional rescuer level or above. These certification units are approved by our Board of Certification, and 10 of these need to be evidence-based medical courses. Alaska, as was mentioned, is one of only two states that currently is not certified. This causes a lot of problems because what we want to do is we want to regulate those that call themselves athletic trainers to ensure the safety of the public and the kids that they treat. What it does is it prevents people who have lost their license or are unable to obtain a license from coming to our state, calling themselves an athletic trainer, and potentially putting the public and our students at risk. So the Alaska Athletic Trainers Association have been proactive in trying to ensure that there is regulation of these professionals. House Bill 160 does not affect any other profession and their scope. It simply states that if you call yourself an athletic trainer, that you hold and maintain the minimal standards required of that healthcare profession. We do not need a separate board. We are governed under a nationally recognized Board of Certification that maintains the domains that we cover, our practice standards, and the discipline as well. As mentioned, there has been some concern by some local coaches and personal fitness trainers. Part of the problem with our profession is the title, and historically we want to keep that title, athletic trainers, but it does open the door to get confused with personal trainers and other people that train. I can assure you that we are not trying to decrease their scope of practice nor limit what they're doing. Personal trainers are highly skilled individuals also who prescribe, monitor individual specific exercise and fitness plans in sometimes a sports setting or in a fitness clinic. Their focus is wellness and injury prevention. Coaches have also raised a concern, and I assure you I work with a lot of coaches, and they are instrumental in maintaining good practices to decrease injuries and preventing injuries as well. Part of their background is by the state of Alaska, ASAA, Alaska School Activities Association, is they're required to take a fundamental of coaching class in addition to a sports injury course and a 20-minute online concussion prevention course. That does not mean that they are a medical professional, and they know that, and they seek for others to help them with the medical decisions. I personally love the fact that they have to take that sports injury because it prevents an injury from getting worse if they have that background in order to know the first crucial steps. I'm also a mom, and my kids are young. They're not in high school or college yet, but they participate in sports, and that's one of the first questions I ask. Are you certified in CPR? Do you know first aid? Because I'm leaving my babies with an individual, and I want to ensure that they have that background in addition. And so the same token with our bill, I'm entrusted with other kids' baby or other parents' babies, and by me saying I'm an athletic trainer, I want to assure them that I have those minimal backgrounds to take care of their children in addition to other people's children's, and that's what we're asking for in addition. In addition to the coaches and the personal fitness trainers' concerns, I heard this morning when I flew off the plane that some physical therapists were concerned as well that we were encroaching on their scope of practice. There's a lot of overlap in a lot of different professions, and one of which is the area of rehabilitation. That is one of the six domains that we as athletic trainers are educated and tested upon. No one practice holds that title to be just theirs. It should be a collaboration working with a bunch of medical individuals in order to get that person back to a safe participation. We work with the athletic corporations, we work with a relationship with different entities. There's athletic trainers in a bunch of variety of settings, and we do a variety of skills. As I said, the Board of Certification has six domains, which we are tested, and that's one of them. Again, there's 48 states that have licensure for athletic trainers. We're the only two, and I assure you that the licensure will not cause others to lose their scope of practice or lose their jobs. Thank you for your time, and I respectfully ask for you to support this. And I just want to say back to the coaches, I left the House side, flew back to Anchorage, and participated in a Alaska school sports clinic that was geared towards school nurses, coaches, and some other personnel as well. So we are there to educate those personnel individuals. By no means after the 2 days of the course does that mean that they can go out and practice medicine, but certainly it does give them tools to help us in preventing serious injuries. So thank you again for your time, and I'm here for any questions.
Great. Thanks, Lynn. Senator Bishop has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thanks for that overview. Are you able to get your credit hours in the state? Or do you have to travel out of state to get your credit hours
for continuing education? Senator Bishop, great question. As far as getting to become an athletic trainer, there's over 300 accredited universities, unfortunately none of which are in Alaska right now. To maintain your CEUs, to keep that, you may. There are some online courses. There are some other we can go to. There was a Girdwood Clinic. The Alaska Orthopedic Society put that on, and athletic trainers, because they are recognized as a mid-level professional in the healthcare, we were able to attend the Orthopedic Society and get CEUs. So there's a lot of opportunities here.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Senator Fairclough.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Welcome. Nice to see you, Lynn. If currently are you working? You're working with physicians and others, and I'm wondering if the licensure gives them different benefits as far as insurance providers and being able to bill those hours.
Through the chair, Senator Fairclough, currently, no. Currently, we outreach out to the high schools and the universities, and we do not directly bill. There are athletic trainers that work with physicians in the clinic setting, and when they perform services as like assisting to brace an individual or instruct on crutch fitting or how to operate crutches, it is billed under incident 2, but that's also available with medical assistants and cast techs, etc., so it's not specific. Athletic trainers do have an NPI number, a national provider identifier, that allows them to have codes regarding certain rehab, et cetera. But currently, in the nature of what we do, if an athlete sprains their ankle on the basketball court and they come to me and I assist them, I'm not sending an insurance bill to that.
Go ahead, Senator Fairclough.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ms. Young, if we were to pass this bill and you were licensed in the state of Alaska, does that affect the billable hours? So then if you provided services and this was passed, would the insurance company then pick up some of those costs?
Through the chair, Senator Fairclough, I apologize. I didn't hear that question correctly. No. What the licensure will do is it will recognize us as a healthcare professional, but no other association.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Great. Thank you, Senator Fairclough. I think that's all the questions for now. Thank you. Thank you, Lynn, for joining us. If we could now go to Dr. Crothers. Welcome to Senate Finance, Dr. Crothers. If you could put your name on the record, please, and proceed.
For the record, my name is Leanne Carruthers. I am the president of the Alaska Physical Therapy Association and a licensed physical therapist. Senator Meyer, thank you for allowing me to testify today. We are having a busy day today, you and I.
Yes, we are. Yeah, it's great.
While the Alaska PT Association strongly supports licensure of healthcare providers for the protection of the public, we have some concerns about some of the language that exists in the current bill. Our concerns are as follows. We have concerns with the use of the word rehabilitation in the proposed scope of practice and in definitions in sections 8.07.030D and 08.07.090 number 4. We believe that the use of the word rehabilitation has the potential to cause consumer confusion, as physical therapists are currently considered the most qualified practitioner for rehabilitation. We would like to see language included that more specifically limits the role of the athletic trainer to injuries sustained or exacerbated while participating in a sport or sports-related activity, and or is designated for the purpose of returning the patient to athletic participation. We also have concerns about the use of the language in the above sections of definitions as they pertain to illness, and would like to see language inserted here that again clarifies that treatment is limited to injuries or conditions associated with participation in sport. There are significant differences in the education and training that are required for athletic trainers and physical therapists, as the entry-level degree required for athletic trainers is a bachelor's degree, and that for physical therapists is an entry-level doctorate. A significant portion of entry-level physical therapy education is on the pathophysiology of acute and chronic illnesses, with special attention to the process of differential diagnosis, which gives physical therapists the skills and tools to safely screen in order to ensure that the patient's clinical participation falls under our scope of practice. That being said, we are in support of athletic trainers attaining licensure, which we believe is in the best interest of the public. In addition, conversations with representatives of Representative Thompson's office and the Athletic Training Association lead us to believe that we'll be able to find statutory language that is mutually agreeable to both professions. I thank you for your time.
Great. Appreciate that that input and the feedback. And I'm assuming that's what the sponsor is working with my staff on, is some changes to that effect. So. Okay, great. Questions for Dr. Carruthers? Okay. Seeing none, thank you very much.
Thank you.
For joining us today. Okay, is there anyone else who wanted to testify online or here in Juneau? Okay, seeing none, then we'll go ahead and close public testimony. There is a fiscal note, as Senator Fairclough mentioned earlier, on these licensing bills. You never know for sure if the fiscal note is going to cover the true cost or not. But I don't know. That may be a good interim project for LBNA, I think, to look at all these board extensions. And Senator Fairclough.
Mr. Chairman, the LBNA committee has created a joint subcommittee on the issue, and we are planning on working with Ms. Chambers and look forward to trying to help with that.
Thank you very much. Okay, then as we heard, there's still a little more work that needs to be done on this bill, so we're going to set this aside as well. Thank you, everyone who testified today. Hopefully we can bring this back up tomorrow. Thank you, Representative Thompson and Brody. Okay, so we'll go to House Bill 116 next. This is committee substitute for House Bill 16, Labor and Commerce. And this pertains to PERS credit for military service. And this is Representative Millitz and her trusty staff. Ige, and you brought somebody with you. So, Ige, I will go ahead and turn the floor over to you if you could introduce yourself, and then whoever else is with you there, if you could put your name on the record. I'm sorry, I don't have your name down here. So, who wants to start?
For the record, my name is Kathy Lee. I'm the Chief Pension Officer for the Division of Retirement and Benefits.
Oh, excellent. Okay. Welcome, Kathy.
And thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the Finance Committee. For the record, my name is Ike Gilopso, staff to Representative Millett. Sends her apologies she could not be here, but sincerely thanks the Finance Committee for hearing her bill. With your permission, Mr. Chairman, I'll give a very brief overview.
Yes, please do.
Thank you, sir. House Bill 116 is addressed at the women and men who served our country as veterans in the armed forces and then turned around and dedicated a career in public service as peace officers or firefighters and are members of either PERS 2 or PERS 3. That is, of course, the tiers of the closed defined benefit system. Mr. Chairman, what House Bill 116 would do is add an additional provision to the existing PERS buyback that is available to employees of that closed system, where they are able to purchase for a certain amount designated time to a maximum level of 5 years credited towards early retirement. That existing system, Mr. Chairman, though, does not address the ability to purchase medical costs. And so the provisions in this bill would allow a peace officer or firefighter who was a veteran of the armed forces, who is a member of TERS 2 or 3, to go to the Division of Retirement and Benefits to ask for an actuarial evaluation as to what the cost would be to purchase that time to an amount that could not exceed 5 years, and then that employee would choose whether or not to make that purchase. Since, Mr. Chairman, the bill is crafted in a way that the peace officer or firefighter would bear the full actuarial cost, there is no fiscal impact to the state of Alaska. And the sponsor's motivation for this, Mr. Chairman, very briefly, is threefold. One is public safety, and in no means does our office mean to throw dispersions on those individuals who are in their 40s and 50s, but walking a beat or climbing a ladder is a younger person's game. And as is seen in almost any profession, the older one gets, the more costly the medical costs are associated with work-related injuries. And so being able to get those individuals out of those high-risk environments and being able to get younger women and men into them is something that's beneficial for public safety. But it's also a sign of respect to those who serve their country in one occupational hazard and had endeavored into another. With that, Mr. Chairman, I'm available to answer any questions that are within my purview as well as Ms. Lee.
Okay. Senator Faircloth, question? Go ahead.
Many,
all right.
My first question is, how long does it take to for a firefighter or a police officer to qualify for benefits, period? Is it 10 years, 20 years, 30 years?
Through the chair, Senator Faircloth. I'm sorry, I apparently don't know where I am today. A peace officer or firefighter will reach eligibility for retirement benefits with 20 years of service. They need to have 25 to have system paid medical if they are in Tier 2 or Tier 3.
Did you have some more questions, sir?
I do, Mr. Chairman. I'm just trying to, so there's a disparity between what's required to acquire a pension that requires 5 more years in Tier 2 and 3 for them to gain health care benefits.
Through the chair, yes, for them to gain system-paid premium health care. They have access to health care at 20 years, but for the system to pay their premiums, they must have 25 years.
When we're, sorry, I'm trying to get it down, Mr. Chairman.
Sure.
When we recognize military service, are we recognizing an honorable discharge?
Through the chair, Senator Faircloth, yes, it must be an honorable discharge.
Mr. Chairman, my question is, do they already qualify for health benefits then under the federal system? If they are honorably discharged, they may.
They may, yes.
So we're going to...
So you're concerned about double dipping? Or?
Well, I'm not concerned. I'm just trying to see what benefits trying to be achieved and then what the person actually will already have. So if they've retired from military service, they may, or I don't know when you would access those, that particular service and have medical benefits available to you at that point. And it's a 25% buyback on at least over the 20 years, more like a 20% buyback over the 25 years. So I'm just contemplating that. I understand that there's an actuarial draw for the pension, but it seems like we're allowing for double benefits then.
Through the chair, Senator Fairclough, I can't speak to what the bill sponsor is anticipating gaining with this bill, but what I can speak to is there are some restrictions within the system for claiming benefits under the military category. If you are already eligible for retirement benefits from your military service. So a person with 20 years of military service that would qualify them for a federal benefit under the PERS statutes cannot claim that service if they're Tier 2 or Tier 3. They would only be able to claim the service if they are not eligible for federal benefits. Now that's federal retirement benefits. I'm not sure about the health benefits.
Okay. Ike, did you have something to add?
Mr. Chairman, for the record, again, Ike Galapsa, staff to Representative Millett. If I may respectfully direct the committee's attention to Statute 3935.340A, perhaps this may elucidate the inquiry from Senator Fairclough. A vested employee is entitled to credited service for active military service in the armed forces of the United States, either by enlistment or induction, if the employee received a discharge under honorable conditions and is not entitled to receive retirement benefits from the United States government for the same service. And that's in the existing statute, Mr. Chairman, Senator Fairclough.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Thank you. Senator
Olson. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Alapsos, I guess one of the questions that I have, if you're doing stuff for Tier 2 and Tier 3, what are you doing for Tier 4?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Olson, my understanding is that because Tier 4 is a defined contribution system and not a defined benefit system, the provisions of health care after a person leaves service are fundamentally different than it would be if they were a member of the defined benefit system. I could be incorrect about that, but I don't believe so.
Through the chair, Senator Olson, because the Tier 4 is a defined contribution plan, there are no provisions to claim any type of service in that plan. None of the benefits other than eligibility for health insurance are predicated on the years of service that you have. A Tier 4 person must retire directly from the plan, must have at least 10 years of service, and be Medicare age eligible to receive retirement health and health coverage.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Senator Olson. Okay, additional questions? Was there anyone online that wanted to testify? Is there anyone here in Juneau? Okay. Senator Perkoff, go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, usually when we have a bill or a policy for consideration, someone has been adversely affected. Can you tell me an adversely affected person so that I understand the context of why you're bringing this forward?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Fairclough, thank you so much for that question. The best example we can give you is when the original PERS buyback had been crafted, several peace officers and firefighters purchased their military time under the assumption that that would bring them full retirement. And right now there are, as I would hope it's in the packet, several letters of support from troopers, from members of municipal police departments and firefighters who are looking to try to retire early. They've purchased their time already towards their pension. They would like the opportunity to purchase their medical time because they recognize that they're a liability to their colleagues as well, simply because of their age, and they still do a fantastic job. But the wear and tear of those two jobs is really getting to them in that regard, and they would like to have that opportunity to make that purchase, to be able to get out of that hazard working condition, and to fulfill what their initial belief was, that this was going to be a purchase towards full retirement.
Go ahead.
Thank you. you for that, those words. Will what they, will what the individuals have paid into the retirement before already count towards the health benefits, or are those two separate calculations?
Through the chair, Senator Faircloth, those are two different calculations. The calculation to use military service to increase the number of years of service for a DB member to increase their retirement benefit is partially subsidized by the employer. So it's a flat percentage of their vesting year salary. This would be an additional cost to that if the member wanted to claim it for pension purposes and also claim it for health. This would be an additional cost. This is a full actuarial cost that will be calculated at the time they retire.
Go ahead, Senator Fergal.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm just pondering current state law and the Constitution and how we address being able to modify benefits. And so if we bring someone else into the system that has higher costs than the average, because we're going to do an actuarial calculation to let somebody buy into benefits, couldn't that be a negative impact on those that are already in the system and that we're changing the cost of the system, or is that?
Through the chair, Senator Faircloth, actually it would have no impact on the remainder of the population in the system, because the individual that is claiming this is paying the full cost for the coverage, and we're looking at a five-year period that it would be calculated over. So they're going to have to give the system the present value of the additional benefits they will receive over their lifetime. That in turn would be invested, and the income on those investments would pay for their coverage.
Anything else?
I appreciate that. That's on a certain set of assumptions, right?
Correct.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, we'll go to Senator Bishop and then Senator Hoffman. Senator Bishop.
Could you? Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Say if I bought the full 5 years, what would that cost me?
Through the chair, Senator Bishop, that would be kind of difficult to say at the moment. You're probably looking at a cost that is around $60,000 to $70,000, potentially more, depending on your age, your circumstances, and how many years you're purchasing.
Thank you.
Okay. Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. If this is net zero, what other tier, what other categories under Tier 2 and Tier 3 could fall into this category and still be a net zero? Or is this the only classification?
Through the chair, Senator, or I almost answered Senator Faircloth. Sorry, but through the chair, Senator Hoffman, we have other types of claim service that are full actuarial cost. Purchasing temporary service to be used for retirement eligibility to reach the 20 or 30 year eligibility is already existent in the statutes. So this is very like that. We also have a public service benefit that is a full actuarial cost that is already in existence.
So your answer is all others already have this option to purchase in at Tier 2 and Tier 3 for other categories of 20 and 30 years for buyback.
Through the chair, Senator Hoffman, they don't. All others do not have this specific provision to purchase military time to be used towards their 30-year retirement.
So, that was my question. If in fact it is a net zero, why are other positions or categories of employment not offered the opt to purchase the time for a 30-year retirement, if in fact it is a net zero?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Hoffman, for the record, Ike Gilopsis, staff to Representative Millett. It was the sponsor's intent to look at a particular segment within Tier 2 and Tier 3 who posed the highest risk in the actuarial pool, those being, of course, Beth. As to why it's not applied that that was the sponsor's intent, at this moment I can't tell you, sir, how it could or could not apply to them or why other legislative champions have not gone to those particular sectors. This was just Representative Millett's focus was on public safety and the veterans of that end.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, thanks, Senator Hoffman. Additional questions? Seeing, hearing none. Senator Faircloth, did you have
anything? No.
Nothing else? Okay. I'm sorry. We closed public hearing. Mm-hmm. There is no public hearing on it.
I didn't have that down.
Yeah, let's take brief eddies though. Okay, we're back. I apologize. I thought I had asked for folks who wanted to testify. There is no one online, correct? So is there anyone in Juneau who wants to testify before I officially close it? Okay, there is none. So we're going to close public testimony. There is a zero fiscal note, as we discussed. Senator Faircloth.
Mr. Chairman, I move the CS for House Bill 116, Labor and Commerce, 28-LS0398/N from committee with attached zero fiscal note and individual committee recommendations.
Okay, is there any objections? Seeing, hearing none, bill moves from committee. Thank you. Ige.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members of the committee.
Okay, we're going to take up one more bill today. So let's take a brief at ease here while we get new speaker.
Senate Finance Committee comes back to order. The next bill before the committee is Senate Bill 48 by Senator Olson. Senator Olson's staff Your name for the record. Please introduce the bill. David?
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, I'm David Scott, staff to Senator Olson. The bill in front of the committee today is it's a CS for Senate Bill 48. I'm looking at version U, just so we have. So it's been over a year since this bill has been heard in the legislature, so I think a very brief
Mr. Scott, here. Could you hold for a moment, brief at ease?
Sure.
Senate Finance Committee is back in session. It's Wednesday, April 16th. Mr. Scott, please continue. Everyone, we do have the CS for Senate Bill number 48, State Affairs, 28-LS0444, version U in front of us.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Again, for the record, David Scott, after Senator Olson. Senate Bill 48, we're seeking to provide relief to a very select and narrow communities in Alaska that have faced hardship due to the PERS, what's called a salary floor, which was established in Senate Bill 125 of the 25th legislature. That bill, Senate Bill 125, changed the PERS system from a multiple employer plan to a what's called a cost share plan. And another way to say that is Senate Bill 125 transferred the individual liability of the 160 PERS employers and consolidate that liability so that all the employers share that liability. Senate Bill 125 also created what we refer to here in the building as the 2008 salary floor. That is, every PERS employer will have a penalty imposed on them if their salary base is below that of what it was at in 2008. This the salary floor was instituted to ensure that the system, the PERS and unfunded liability, that the system cannot be gamed, that communities couldn't try to hire folks on a contract basis and therefore allowing their base payments to shrink, their payments to the unfunded liability. Many municipalities, due to circumstances out of their control, beyond their control, have found themselves below the 2008 floor. Some of these are very small and remote communities. Some are, in the instance of a good example is Galena. Galena had an Air Force base closed in 2010, and they lost roughly 35% of their total population in the city, and their 2008 floor is 36 employees, and right now they're at 17. And the community has suffered because of not only the closure of the base, but they are now facing a huge they're being penalized because they're below the 2008 floor. Right now their bill, last year when the bill was drafted and we tried to get it through the process here in the legislature, their bill was roughly $420,000. This year they've got a new assessment, new bill, and that bill is now up to $646,000, and they are charged at a 12% interest. So this, so what we're doing here with this bill, there's really the two most important sections are 1 and 2. Section 1 stops the bleeding. Section 1, what we do in Section 1 is we say that those municipalities in Alaska that lost more than 25% of their population between the census of 2000 and the census of 2010, if those communities would, attorney say that those communities that lost 25% between 2000 and 2010 will have a new floor. That new floor would be June 30th, 2012. So what we're trying to do with Section 1 is stop the bleeding so that they don't keep accumulating these huge bills from the state, basically. Section 2 is we're trying to provide relief there, Section 2, provide relief to those communities who are facing these large bills from the state because of
they've fallen below the 2008 floor. The Section 3 makes both sections retroactive, and Section 4 is an immediate effective date. It should be also noted, Mr. Chairman, or Madam Chair, I don't know, Mr. Chairman, that those communities, you should have an email in your packet that those communities that have lost 25% between 2000 and 2010 censuses are Galena, Pelican, Atka, Anderson, and St. George. You should also be noted that the two communities that have outstanding balances that haven't been able to pay their contributions of court to the 2008 floor are Galena and St. George. I think it's fair to say, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, that if we do nothing here, that the bills going to these two communities are going to keep rising and rising. And I think that it's also fair to say that the state of Alaska and the PERS system will never ever see this money if we don't try to do something now, soon. And so with that, I can answer some questions. Oh, I guess one more point that the committee should also know about is that municipalities in Alaska cannot declare bankruptcy. The state law has to specifically allow for communities to declare bankruptcy, and Alaska law does not provide for that. There's a legislative research that should be in your packet. It was dated March 1st, 2013, and it gets into details on that. And with that, Deputy Commissioner of Administration Mike Barnhill is in the room, and I also have Scott Ruby, who is the Division Director for Community and Regional Affairs and Commerce, is also available. If there are any questions about city disillusionment or along those lines, and I could also try to answer questions.
Okay, very good. Thank you, David. Are there questions? Go ahead, Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. It's obviously pointed out that these communities are in dire straits with an insurmountable burden that they will never overcome. My question, though, Mr. Chairman, is if it's okay with you, Mr. Scott, what are the other communities, what are their avenues of trying to go ahead and make themselves whole? Pelican, St. George, and the others, have they been actively doing anything? We've only heard mainly from Galena. I was wondering what the other communities are doing. And maybe you're not the person to ask.
Through the chair, Senator Olson, you should see that there are communities that have lost 25% of their population between 2000 and 2010. And I did name them, but Pelican is one of them, and they have fully paid. They don't have any outstanding delinquent contributions. So Pelican is completely paid, as well as Anderson. And Atka they did not have any, as I look at this, they did not have any PERS employees. So the only two, again, are St. George and Galena that are delinquent in their contribution. That all have also lost a population of over greater than 25% between the two decennial censuses.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. So, if I'm understanding this correctly, basically, you're asking the state to pick up their share of their PERS contributions?
Through the chair, or Mr. Chairman, that's how the bill's written right now, is to stop, number one, stop the bleeding, and number two, forgive the delinquent contribution penalty. That's how the bill's written now. I would think that the sponsor would argue that the most important thing is to stop the bleeding now for these communities, because their bill to the state, to the PERS system, is going to keep growing and growing and growing. And right now it's at 12% is what they're paying on $690,000. And that's up from last year from $420,000.
So there's no hope of them being able to pay this anytime in the near future?
Mr. Chairman, Galena is actually even, they've taken a low interest loan through the bond bank to try to help with their community costs. They've also just gone through a huge flood. I just don't think there's a way that Galena could ever pay that off of the state. It's just going to keep growing if we don't stop something. And I don't think, you know, maybe Galena, I believe somebody's online from Galena. If we,
I don't have anybody online. Or do I?
They were available till 3. I don't know if they were able to come back.
Okay. Additional questions? Otherwise, I'm going to ask Mr. Barnhill to join us here. Okay. We do have Scott Ruby. Any questions for David? If not, or Senator Olson? Go ahead, Senator Bishop.
Mr. Chairman, just a comment. I might be off, but I'm going to make it, Dave, and you see if I'm close. Galena got a double whammy. They got the floor from 2008 is from SB 125, and then they got caught in a BRAC round. So they were just kind of snake bit, if you will.
Mr. Chairman, I can't put it any better. They're like in a vice. Their steel jaws are coming at them from both ends there.
Okay. Mr. Barnhill, thank you for joining us today. Do you have any comments on this bill?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mike Barnhill, Deputy Commissioner, Department of Administration. I don't have any comments by way of explanation. I thought Mr. Scott did a fine job on that. There is a fiscal note associated with that because the bill does have retroactive effect for those participating employers that are caught in this vice that would benefit from this bill. They get the benefit of a decreased rate of interest that has an impact on the system, and the impact is detailed on the fiscal note.
Senator Fairclough.
Mr. Chairman, I'd point out that it shows the fiscal note number one from the Department of Administration shows in FY 2014, $187,000, FY 15, $176,000, 16, $167,000, FY 17, $157,000, FY 18, $148,000, FY 19, $139,000. So it appears that the contribution by the state would go down, but I would focus your attention on estimated supplemental FY 2013 cost of $706,000.
And Mr. Chair, to clarify, we're not seeking an appropriation. That just reflects the impact of the retroactivity of the bill. Those are amounts that we won't be collecting under existing law if the bill is enacted into law.
Do you think you'll ever collect it?
Well, it's hard to speculate on what the future holds for municipalities like Galena, but one can't rule out that their fortunes may turn around at some point in the future.
Mr. Chairman, if I could comment on that?
Go ahead, Senator.
I think the chances of them being able to collect, the administration, you know, either they're not seeing reality or there's an issue out there, because Galena has suffered a major flood in this last period of time where many of the houses that were taken off their pilings are sitting over on the side, and people can't even move back, and because of that there's been a significant decrease in not just the general population but also the school membership that's there. So the chances of them be able to pull something out like this is and if they get hit with another flood, there's going to be even more of a migration up toward Fairbanks. As we saw the last time around, the flood was so bad it was threatening the airport, and we were getting ready, and helicopters did go in to try and take people out of there. So I would be very pessimistic, and put it that way, unless Mr. Barnhill has been out there, I've been out there a number of times and saw the devastation that was there, so the chance of them coming out are minimal at best.
Senator Fairclough.
Mr. Chairman, I'm wondering about the system as a whole and how the issue of fairness to the state picking up costs for one city versus costs of the other, how that would be seen. Specifically, I know that we have multiple, I think it's the Municipal League, who is asking for us to eliminate the termination studies for the similar reasons for other cities. So I think you're poking at a bee's nest if we choose winners and losers. We have a problem that communities across our state are speaking to. We had a presentation earlier today about our PERS and TERS system, and a large contribution that would buy that down would reduce those payments. So this particular bill is talking about the bleeding, per se, of one particular community, but we have communities across our state that are burdened by the floor, per se, of the 2008 salaries costs as far as a contribution goes.
Through the chair, Senator Fairclough and Senator Olson, I don't want to let anything I say today suggest in any way that I'm diminishing the substantial burdens that Galena and other communities are facing. I do think it is becoming more and more of a statewide issue in terms of particularly smaller communities' ability to sustain participation in PERS on an ongoing basis. And I think as each year, you know, we come back to the table and we evaluate what's going on with our smaller communities, more and more we're going to have to face the reality of how are we going to deal with these communities that are continuing to have delinquencies for whatever reason, whether it's a flood or an Air Force base that closes, a revenue stream that disappears. And don't have for the committee today a recommendation on how we deal with that, but there are a number of communities, and it's starting to get into the dozens, that simply are having a very difficult time in sustaining participation in the public employee retirement system.
Go ahead, Senator Fairclough.
Mr. Chairman, the issue of the pension liability is burdening everyone, which is why the governor has certainly suggested a cash infusion. We've had municipalities throughout the state into our offices talking about the termination study, and the state is taking on the most crucial from the ARM board's perspective as far as the cash infusion goes. But I have empathy where I would like to solve it for one community, but I don't want to solve it at the disadvantage of a dozen other communities or the entire system as a whole. The state is transitioning from being able to meet our obligations to looking at drawing from reserves, and how do we, this bill seems to be an entire year's worth of conversation to try to look at that. It seems reasonable to try to reduce the interest rate when we know folks are struggling to take less, but I guess my question, Mr. Chairman, is if the city fails to make the payments, period, and just stops, what does the state do? Are those the employees that are affected by their status of not paying not entitled to benefits any longer? Or can you give me a structure of taking Galena's story aside or St. George, taking those out of the picture and just talking about the mechanics if someone doesn't pay, what do we do? If you could tell me the process.
Sure. Through the chair, Senator Fairclough, to date, the process that we've engaged in is to send notices of delinquency on a periodic basis. The statute does provide the Department of Administration authority to intercept municipal revenue sharing. To date, we have not exercised that right. But as the delinquency list begins to grow from a plan administration perspective, the state's reticence in exercising that intercept needs to be examined. I think we've forestalled exercising that as this legislation's been pending for a bit to see if this body can provide some relief that would eliminate the necessity to intercept fully these amounts. But I think the time is coming as the delinquency list grows that a prudent plan administrator needs to exercise its powers consistent with its fiduciary duties. So that is something I think we need to start taking a look at.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Olson, go ahead.
I'd like to go back to Senator Faircloth's question again. Are these employees not going to be getting their retirement benefits if they are if there are delinquent payments that aren't being made or not being made?
Right. Thank you.
Is that compromised?
Mr. Chair, I didn't address that part of the question. So the employees are still participants in the system and are still entitled to their benefits. We can also begin termination of a participating employer. That's another means to do that. If we terminate a particular employer, then the employees of that employer have the right to refund their account or vest immediately in the system.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Sure. Senator Hoppin.
Then you probably don't have the answer to this, but for $420,000 for a community of 470, it would take maybe a dozen or more years of revenue sharing to pay that debt off. And they are utilizing that, probably their revenue sharing, just to keep their offices open for a small community of this size, because most of the communities that are in the neighborhood of 100 to 500 use their revenue sharing to keep their municipal offices open. The other point that I would like to make is that, you know, in 2010 there was 470 people there, so a family of four, if everybody in the community had to come up to make those payments, a family of four would have to come up with in excess of $3,500, closer to $3,600. So although it could be said that we need to delay this and look at the broader picture, at least for Galena, it seems as though they're hit by three fronts: this issue, the closure of the base, and the flood. And for that reason, we should put the other communities on notice that we're going to look at what they're doing, but give some relief to Galena, at least at this stage, because it seems to me that if we don't do any action, the community is going to close its municipal doors. And if it were any other place, we would take action to stop closing those municipal doors.
Is there any PERS employees in Galena?
Mr. Chair, yes.
Okay.
I believe there is. I don't have a number, but I think Mr. Scott referenced it a few minutes ago.
Mr. Chairman, the numbers we have are there's 17 now.
Okay. Is there any economic activity in Galena?
Home repair,
yeah. And so the base closed, that there is a military base? Okay. And no hope of that reopening? Senator Faircloth, did you have a question?
Mr. Chairman, you asked, and I was wondering how many PERS employees were affected.
Okay. Anything else, Mr. Barnhill, David?
I guess, Mr. Chairman, from the committee's perspective, they have 17 current employees. However, they're being charged as having 36 employees. Their contribution, supposed contribution to the state, is for 36 employees, which is the 2008 floor, even though right now there's 17.
Gotcha. Senator Faircloth.
Mr. Chairman, I believe that's because 36 employees will retire from our system. That's why they're paying those contributions at the rate of 36 employees, because the system is responsible for paying benefits to 36 people, not just the 17 that are remaining.
But, Mr. Chairman, to the chair, Senator Faircloth, that's another way of saying that that's the 2008 floor.
Okay, very good. Well, this is the big issue. I don't think we're going to get solved today or even this session. The whole PERS thing, the termination studies, communities that can't make contributions, it's an issue, Mr. Barnhill, that hopefully you can help us with a solution over the interim to come back next session to deal with.
Mr. Chair, we're certainly willing to work over the session on exploring solutions, because it is becoming more and more of a concern.
So
Senator Fairclough.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Barnhill, is the 25% loss of the census a good measurement that would help all 12 communities versus just Galena?
Through the chair, Senator Fairclough, at one point we had a census table. I think, David, did you have that? Maybe that could be provided to the committee. It did have employer by employer the population loss, and you could see how many participating employers were scooped in at the 25% level, and then how many at the 20% level. And I remember seeing this chart last year. Is that it? Oh, here it comes.
I don't have it right now.
We can provide this to the committee.
Mr. Chairman, the question was, is it a good threshold, or is 20% from the department's perspective a better threshold, or if we're looking at delinquencies?
At this point, I'm not really prepared to comment on what is the best threshold. I'd probably defer to the sponsor on a recommendation on threshold, because there's a tension here. Obviously, we'd like to collect the money.
Mr. Chairman, is there a different criteria that the Senate should be looking at?
Mr. Chair, Senator Fairclough, I think one of the things that needs to be looked at is is there a prospect for a sustainable revenue base within the community that can support continued participation in the system over the next 10, 20 years? And if there isn't, then I really think we have to come to grips with what are we going to do? If there simply is not a revenue base, do we begin termination on these employers and look for an alternative retirement system that they can participate in that on a sustainable basis, for instance? Are there other ways of looking at it? I'm sure there are, but I guess my primary concern as the department that administers these things is that I don't like to see the list of delinquencies grow every year.
Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Barnhill, the chairman said that it's unlikely that we can deal with it this year, and asked for your input over this next year to come up with recommendations. But you earlier said you were looking at this committee to see what action would be taken on this bill, and the option of intercepting their revenue sharing checks might be in the balance. So I guess my question to you is, are you going to withhold the implementation of that particular section of the law until this legislature addresses this issue next year, or are you going to implement that and withhold their revenue sharing payments, since the chairman had suggested that you come up with a plan?
Through the chair, Senator Hoffman, I think that's a fair question, and what I did say is I think we need to re-examine our reticence in utilizing the intercept. I think we will re-examine our reticence in that regard, but I think at the same time it's fair in response to the request of the committee to look at some solutions that might avoid us having to use that.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Senator Hoffman. Okay, well, that's going to conclude our work for today. Appreciate the committee's indulgence. So we heard a lot of bills. Some of these bills you'll see again tomorrow as well. There's some new ones that have been read across. House Bill 328, another licensing bill, massage therapist. And then House Bill 143, commercial fishing crew member license. And House Bill 282, Landlord-Tenant Act. Education bill, I hope we'll have one tomorrow. Not sure on that yet. And Senator Kelly, anything on PERS?
Tomorrow we should have...
Use the microphone, please.
Tomorrow we should have the House bill.
Okay, the House bill should be coming over on PERS, so we'll continue work on that as well as hopefully the education bill. Okay, anything else come for the committee? If not, we're adjourned.